We've had a fine trip, a full and challenging trip, and as I said this morning, a successful trip.
After a 10-day tour of Europe, President Reagan came home on Friday, and the world began examining the accomplishments and possible consequences. The big story this week, hits and misses on Reagan's trip. It was intended as a journey of reconciliation with a former enemy and a show of unity with economic competitors. But the wreath-laying at a cemetery for German soldiers was marred by protesters. So were Reagan's speeches in Spain and Portugal. The economic summit in Bonn accomplished precious little, with France the lone holdout on an attempt to deal with world trade problems. Mitterrand was so unhappy that when he got home, he hinted he might not attend next year's summit in Japan. He called the get-togethers an imitation institution, but Reagan sees it differently.
At the Bonn Economic Summit, we agreed to a common strategy to ensure continued economic prosperity and job creation. We also moved closer to our goal of launching a new multilateral trade round to eliminate barriers to free trade. All the summit countries have agreed to the need for a new round. All but one agreed that it should begin early next year. We were pleased that our partners endorsed U.S. efforts in Geneva to achieve significant reductions in nuclear arms. We also reached agreement for intensified cooperation against international drug trafficking.
The European Parliament in Strasbourg was the setting for the next important attempt by Reagan to influence European governments.
Monsieur le Président!
40 years of peace since VE Day have also been 40 years of East-West division. Since the 1970s, President Reagan said the U.S. has not had nuclear superiority over the Soviets, and the president charged that the Soviets now seek a clear first-strike capability.
The Soviet Union is now moving toward deployment of new mobile MIRV missiles, which have these capabilities, plus the potential to avoid detection, monitoring, or arms control verification. In doing this, the Soviet Union is undermining stability and the basis for mutual deterrence.
The president told the European parliamentarians that the U.S. and Western response should not be to regain superiority, but to pursue another approach.
It is to offset the continued Soviet offensive buildup in destabilizing weapons by developing defenses against these weapons. In 1983, I launched a new research program, the Strategic Defense Initiative. The state of modern technology may soon make possible, for the first time, the ability to use non-nuclear systems to defeat ballistic missiles.
That is the so-called Star Wars plan, and it is a major worry to Europeans who feel that a shield which guards the U.S. may leave Europe vulnerable. The European Parliament is a forum with more bark than bite, but it represents the full range of political opinion in the 10-member countries of Western Europe. Some delegates, who obviously disagree with the president, staged a demonstration in protest.
Today, we see similar Soviet efforts to profit from and stimulate regional conflicts in Central America. They haven't been there. I have. Maybe if I talk long enough in my own Congress, some of those will walk out.
There was no reference in the president's speech to the fact that 40 years ago, the Soviets were allies who helped win the war. The president did send a separate message to the Kremlin to mark the anniversary. The president said, too, that he has directed Secretary of State Shultz to engage the Soviets in a problem-solving agenda. Shultz meets Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko in Vienna next week.
It is my hope that in the 21st century, which is only 15 years away, all Europeans from Moscow to Lisbon will be able to travel without a passport, and the free flow of people and ideas will include the other half of Europe.
Building Europe, the president said, is like building a great cathedral. The work is slow, complicated, and painstaking. The president's speech bore the mark of National Security Advisor Robert McFarlane. Tough as it was, there were others in the White House who reportedly wanted it tougher. Yet unmistakably, while the president was addressing West Europeans, his words were directed at the Kremlin heart of East Europe.
Last stop, Lisbon, where for a change there are no burning controversies to distract from the president's visit. Nevertheless, there was a spark of discord when two bombs exploded Tuesday night at a Radio Free Europe tower 38 miles northeast of Lisbon. An anti-capitalist group claimed responsibility. For a while, it looked as if the Portuguese MPs were going to let the feathers fly by releasing the white dove as the president spoke. But after an American agent checked the bird out, a Portuguese official removed it. Nevertheless, shortly after the president arrived, the protest show went on as 44 communist MPs walked out. The walkout was, however, orderly, almost polite, and the president delivered his speech uninterrupted, except for friendly applause.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry that some of the chairs on the left seem to be uncomfortable.
It was an address that praised democratic ideals.
Well, it is this trust in the individual, the right to speak, to assemble, to publish, and to vote, even to walk out, that is the meaning of democracy.
As throughout this trip, the president again emphasized the importance of the Western alliance.
And NATO has worked. We have kept the peace for 40 years. Let us keep the peace another 40 years and another after that.
The president's reception in Portugal was generally warm, and looking back on his rigorous 10-day journey, he declared it fruitful in results and rich in memory. Secretary of State Schultz said the most important result was the president's message, freedom is right, freedom works.
From my own standpoint, I would say that it was a very hard-working trip, and I'm a little on the tired side now, but I think it's all been really worthwhile.
The president's last official act was a toast to Portugal's democratic health at a glittering state dinner. The controversy over Bitburg, the standoff at the Bonn summit, and the noisy protest in the European Parliament were put aside for a time. But those will surely be among the lingering images from this trip. Reconciliation and allied unity were the president's overriding themes, but events showed that neither has been fully achieved.
Beyond the slogans on the walls here and today's walkout, Portugal has still proved less controversial than the rest of the trip to Europe, but not many Portuguese have turned out to see him either in the course of the presidential motorcades around Lisbon. The shanty housing that he has not seen underlines why the Portuguese government wants him here. The poorest country in Europe desperately needs foreign investment. Some close to Prime Minister Mario Soares say that in return he's prepared to offer America bases here, and that has not endeared him to the peace movement. But the White House is more concerned with what officials term European frustration with the verbal East-West attrition that has marked his trip.
President Reagan met here separately with the two symbols of Portuguese democracy, General Antonio Ramalho Yanes, president for nearly a decade, and Socialist Prime Minister Mario Soares. Together, they saved Portugal from a takeover by left-wing soldiers in 1975. But today, they are bitter rivals, and their animosity is fueling the political instability that has been the bane of Portugal's democratic experience.
Still to come, Reagan survives sensitive Sunday.
President Reagan failed to score any significant breakthroughs at the Bonn summit, although senior aides traveling with him, as expected, said they were pleased.
Economic summits rarely produce decisions which significantly affect the world economic scene, but many economists believe they are useful nonetheless because they force summit nation leaders to study up on arcane economic issues they normally leave to subordinates and to make decisions on them.
On Sunday, Reagan moved on to the emotional peak of his journey. At the former concentration camp of Bergen-Belsen, he spoke with eloquence.
There, a different wordsmith, specially recalled to the White House for the occasion, crafted Mr. Reagan's attempt to display sensitivity to the ghosts of the Holocaust.
Surely we can understand that when we see what is around us. All these children of God, under bleak and lifeless mounds, the plainness of which does not even hint at the unspeakable acts that created them. Here they lie, never to hope, never to pray, never to love, never to heal, never to laugh, never to cry. Everywhere here are memories pulling us, touching us, making us understand that they can never be erased. Such memories take us where God intended his children to go, toward learning, toward healing, and above all, toward redemption. They beckon us through the endless stretches of our heart to the knowing commitment that the life of each individual can change the world and make it better.
Then on to the Bitburg Military Cemetery, where a few of Hitler's elite troops are buried, along with many German soldiers of World War II. By laying a wreath and remaining silent, the president struck a delicate balance between honoring the former enemy and burying the animosities of the past. Then back to Air Force One.
At Bitburg Air Base, one of NATO's most important and a future site for new American nuclear missiles, President Reagan chose to sound a political note, relating his familiar anti-communist and anti-Soviet themes to memories of the Holocaust.
22 years ago, President John F. Kennedy went to the Berlin Wall and proclaimed that he, too, was a Berliner. But today, freedom-loving people around the world must say, I am a Berliner. I am a Jew in a world still threatened by anti-Semitism. I am an Afghan, and I am a prisoner of the Gulag. I am a refugee in a crowded boat foundering off the coast of Vietnam. I am a Laotian, a Cambodian, a Cuban, and a Mosquito Indian in Nicaragua.
On boarding his plane, the president was applauded by his staff for his handling of Sensitive Sunday. On Monday, the president flew to Madrid, where he was greeted by King Juan Carlos and Queen Sofia. Reagan tried hard to reinforce important ties with Spain, but ran into some flack.
He wants Spain to stay in NATO. Prime Minister Gonzalez agrees, but is committed to holding a referendum on the issue next year. The polls show a majority of Spaniards want out. Other polls reveal that up to 73% favor closing the four U.S. military bases in Spain, which house about 12,600 American troops. Secretary of State Schultz met for 2 hours with his Spanish counterpart, and officials say was told that Spain may want to reopen talks with the goal of reducing U.S. troop presence here. Disagreement has prompted demonstrations. Many Spaniards greeted the president by turning out their lights and banging pots and pans in protest. The day before, hundreds of thousands of protesters hit the streets, prompting one conservative politician to call the atmosphere surrounding the president's visit deplorable. Several thousand protesters gathered barely 500 yards from the American embassy. They were angry. They chanted, "No to NATO. American bases out of Spain. Victory to the Sandinistas. Reagan, go home." The crowd spilled onto the street, one of the busiest in Madrid. There was a huge traffic jam. The police tried to unblock the road, and it wasn't long before things got nasty. There were injuries on both sides. Repeated efforts by the police to break up the crowd were unsuccessful, and as the evening wore on, the situation got worse. After a brief lull, a small group of radicals moved towards the embassy, throwing rocks and bottles. The police charged, backed by reinforcements. Noisy and nasty, the demonstration was not as large as the huge protests which took place the day before the president arrived. Secretary of State Schultz said Mr. Reagan had seen friendly crowds while motorcading through Madrid and noted that for many Spaniards,
the demonstrations, they feel, were organized by what they describe as a small minority, and they're quite embarrassed about them.
The president didn't see any of Monday's trouble. He was with the Spanish royal family in an 18th century tapestry room. And when asked how his visit had gone, he was upbeat.
There's been a very great friendship between our two countries.
But friendship was nowhere in evidence as police and demonstrators skirmished in the streets, the violence underscoring the intensity of feeling among those Spaniards opposed to the president's visit and policies.
The president, however, took it all in stride.
Sam, I don't know anyone in the world that's more used to demonstrations than I am.
Spain has long disagreed with the Reagan administration's attitude toward Nicaragua, and the announcement of the trade embargo last week, just before Mr. Reagan came here, did not ease the tension on that issue. When asked by reporters about the Nicaragua issue, the president said he thinks many people misunderstand the U.S. policy and the true sympathies of the Ortega government.
Victims of a disinformation campaign, as perhaps even some of you present have been.
The
president had seen reports from Washington of House Speaker Tip O'Neill's conclusion that Congress was embarrassed by Ortega when the Nicaraguan leader visited Moscow immediately following a congressional vote against U.S. aid to the Contras, who are trying to topple Ortega. With Spanish Prime Minister Felipe González, the president discussed Nicaragua again.
We have discussed the situation there. I think we understand each other.
Did you agree to disagree, sir? Is that it?
No. We have had very fine talks.
The Spanish Prime Minister, however, left it clear Spain would like to see a new initiative for peace in Central America rather than Mr. Reagan's trade embargo. The basic disagreement, says the Secretary of State, is the degree to which Spain thinks Nicaragua is becoming a Soviet satellite.
But my impression is they held the view that, yes, that seems to be true, but perhaps there's still some hope. And so there's a difference in analysis.
But the president's formal statement gingerly avoided any implications of agreement.
We noted that further efforts are needed to strengthen peace, democracy, and economic progress in Central and South America. And I know this is a region of special interest to Spain, as it is to the United States.
The president and his advisors did, however, take some solace from the fact that House Speaker Tip O'Neill says Nicaraguan President Ortega's visit to Moscow makes renewed aid to the Contras worth reconsidering. White House officials say there was agreement with the Spaniards, but only on the broadest objectives of the need for peace, democracy, and negotiation in Central America.
Indicative of the Spanish position on Nicaragua is the fact that President Daniel Ortega is being welcomed as an official guest in Madrid this weekend.
In Spain, the president met with a group of prominent business managers, encouraging them to prod their government to lower taxes and remove regulations which restrict economic growth. Spain's King Juan Carlos sat behind the president, listening to Mr. Reagan's prescription for economic success. Before leaving Germany this week, the president delivered a similar message to students. Mr. Reagan is pushing small business, private enterprise.
One top American computer firm was actually started by two college students in a garage behind their house.
Like a campaign speech, the message was the same a day later in Madrid.
One of the largest, most successful personal computer firms in America was started by two college students in the garage behind their house.
In Germany, the president cited German free enterprisers. In Madrid, it was a hero who came to Spain for financing for his venture.
Christopher Columbus was one of the original entrepreneurs.
Spain has one of Europe's weakest national economies. Its prime minister is a socialist, but Spain has joined the European Economic Community. Alongside the array of foreign policy goals the president has pursued here in Europe, the free market economic theme has been an important sideshow on this trip. Mr. Reagan, at every stop, has tried to sell his theory that free enterprise, unhampered by government regulation, is the magic elixir for Europe's sluggish economies.
Still to come, CNN's reporters sum it all up. CNN's chief White House correspondent, Charles Bierbauer, saw a positive side to the president's trip.
All negative? By no means. It was a difficult trip for the president, but the image he likes to see was there too. The smiles, the flags, the waves as he rode through a small German town en route to a campaign-style rally with thousands of German students.
Europe today, divided by concrete walls, by electrified barbed wire, and by mined and manicured fields, killing fields, it is a living portrait of the most compelling truth of our time. The future belongs to the free.
The specter of the evil empire, an early Reagan epithet for the Soviet Union, also resurfaced in a VE Day speech to the European Parliament, and nasty public exchanges flew between Moscow and the traveling White House.
Now, the Soviet Union, however, does not share our view of what constitutes a stable nuclear balance. It has chosen instead to build nuclear forces clearly designed to strike first and thus disarm their adversary.
Sometimes the best of times can be the worst of times, and the president had to weather what may have been the roughest trip of his presidency.
In contrast to previous presidential globetrotting, the Chinese wall, the Korean DMZ, White House planners thought this trip would be more verbal than visual. As it turns out, the Reagan image in Europe has been both controversial and dramatic.
Frank Sesno also covers the White House for CNN.
From the outset, the president's message was as clouded as his mission. First by Bitburg, then by his policy toward Nicaragua, then by summit impasse and parliamentary protest. What the president had wanted to emphasize in his travels were the twin themes of post-war reconciliation and Allied unity. The main distraction, the visit to the German war cemetery at Bitburg, was a moment the president simply had to endure. The president called for improved ties with the Soviets, serious arms talks, and realism. There was no talk of the Soviets ending up on the ash heap of history.
The United States does not seek to undermine or change the Soviet system, nor to impinge upon the security of the Soviet Union.
In addition to the statesman Reagan was the salesman Reagan. He preached Reaganomic-style reform for Europe, freer trade, and the entrepreneurial spirit.
The journey to Europe has involved many highs and, yes, some anguishing moments. We are leaving today with our Atlantic ties strengthened, and we're returning home, mission accomplished.
So while the President and Mrs. Reagan relax at Camp David this weekend, his performance in Europe draws mixed reviews. Says Tom Wicker in the New York Times, it became too frequently an occasion for bitterness and recrimination, even among friends, and wound up in a warlike exchange of accusations with Gorbachev, the Soviet leader. Joseph Kraft in the Washington Post wrote, President Reagan's European trip was not the triumph some of us had foreseen. Neither was it the disaster many predicted. In the same paper, Hobart Rowan wrote, as soon as they began, sarcastically, to call it the Bitburg Summit, it was a sign that nothing much was going to be accomplished on economic problems at Bonn. In the end, it turned out to be close to a bust. But the Wall Street Journal concludes, the president offered new goals, and that is the best way to overcome European cynicism and fear. To judge by the pageantry, the trip made good television.
It marked a swan song of the man who selected the settings for the president, Michael Deaver, who is retiring. Reagan appeared to enjoy the imperial touches, like bugles announcing his entrances. He quipped, there are going to be some changes at the White House. But on substance, there were hits and misses on the Reagan trip. The big story this week.
This is Don Miller, CNN.